Hello everyone and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly news roundup podcast, where we take a critical look at a number of topical developments from the past few days with a leadership and management theme. I am Rod Jones, Content Manager at the Institute, and in this podcast we will be looking at news up to the 29th of June 2020. Joining me to analyse these stories is Kate Cooper, Head of Research, Policy and Standards at the Institute. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Rod.
Well, our first story, Kate, asks which skills helped Klopp send the cop to the top? Now, Liverpool FC have become Premier League kings following the resumption of UK football despite COVID-19 disruption to the fixture schedule and crowd-free games. Coach Jurgen Klopp has distinguished himself in the public eye with his calm, focused and apparent lack of ego. Former Liverpool player Jamie Carragher said, "The supporters look to what Klopp says about every situation, and he always finds the right words. Jurgen claims he doesn't prepare what he's going to say, but I don't believe him. He has a great ability to communicate. He has this special quality to say the right thing." Player Jordan Henderson said, "The biggest thing he's got is that no matter what, we all follow him. We all believe in him." Kate, what are the leadership skills that have led to what Klopp describes as the biggest development jump in his players?
Well, Rod, if we look at our five dimensions of leadership, authenticity, vision, ownership, collaboration, what Klopp has undoubtedly done is achieved the fifth one, hasn't he? He's delivered results. And results in football are so stark. So therefore, we're looking to explain this brilliant Liverpool season by his fantastic leadership. What we don't have is an identical team without Klopp as the manager who are not achieving those results or even doing even better if that's possible. So is it ever so difficult to say it's him that has caused this? Because sometimes, as we saw with Leicester City a couple of seasons ago, the right things happen, a sort of magic synergy emerges and people exceed their own expectations. But having seen him being interviewed, what I'd say, if there's something about Klopp that sets him apart from perhaps other managers, is his ability to empathize. He seems to know what the fans want. He knows what the media want from him. He obviously knows what his players expect from him. He's looking at the world not only from his point of view but from their point of view, and I think that's why we say he doesn't appear to have the ego of so many other managers. So that's what he's doing right. And to me, where he really stands out is that his credibility as a football coach, a footballer in his own right, he never strays off into talking about things that he doesn't understand. If it's not football, he doesn't comment. So you really trust that when he does speak, he knows what he's talking about.
Thank you very much, Kate. And Liverpool fans, I think, will hope this long continues. Our next question asks if every big brand should have an activism manager. According to Ben & Jerry's global head of activism, Christopher Miller, brands should enlist specifically dedicated activism managers to help them deliver tangible social change. In a recent interview with The Drum, Miller stressed that one strategic aim the ice cream firm regards as a core mission is to help to dismantle white supremacy, a goal that has already led the brand to join various campaigns and make official representations to arms of the US government. Just 2 days after the interview, Ben & Jerry's validated Miller's point by announcing that it has joined the hashtag Stop Hate for Profit campaign and pulled its paid advertising from Facebook, urging the social network to stop its platform from being used to spread and amplify racism and hate. Kate, should firms view their corporate social responsibility work as activism to enhance its impact and hire relevant leadership figures to manage it?
I think they're two separate questions really there, Rod. Should firms view their CSR responsibility as activism? Absolutely. Should they use their power as a old owner of a brand, but also as a purchaser, as an employer, as a supplier, to actually say, we only want to work with ethical companies. We want to manifest, we want to role model that which we think is great and right about organisations. And to be truly ethical, that should actually permeate everything they do. So they shouldn't be giving money to Facebook if they think Facebook are not doing enough to stop hate and to monitor fake news. So they're doing exactly the right thing. Whether you need dedicated activist managers for this, I don't know. That might give you another set of problems, because they are working to a different agenda, aren't they, Rod? Because ultimately, Ben and Jerry's are purveyors of ice cream. And of course, they can use that business activity to be activists. But to what extent should they be funding activism for activism's sake? And will that adversely impact the business? That's a question only Ben and Jerry's can really answer.
Right, thank you, Kate. Our next question asks how employers and employees can benefit from supporting working carers. New research by the CIPD and the University of Sheffield, UK, shows that almost 3.7 million employees in England and Wales are working carers, but around half are struggling to combine work and care. Most working carers had experienced difficulty in concentrating at work because of their caring responsibilities, and 28% of working carers said that coming home from work too tired to do some of the caring tasks that need to be done was something they experienced at least once a week. The research also found that employer support makes a substantial difference to the ability of working carers to combine work and care. Working from home and flexi time are particularly beneficial. Kate, would you agree with the research findings that employees should develop policies and practices to become more carer friendly?
Absolutely. I think if COVID-19 imposed home working has taught us anything, it's about the diversity and complexity of people's lives and how much people are trying to combine with a working day. And if we think about it, care workers that work in care settings are paid. Nursery teachers and school teachers looking after children are paid. People who are working in old people's homes are paid. And to think that you can do that as well as a different job is just too stressful, I think, and too difficult. And if employers recognise that one of the ways that people can manage that double burden is by flexible working, is by being understood. I'm really going back to the empathy I was talking about with Klopp. Understanding the problem from the other person's point of view, I think just the support, the interest itself could be so helpful for these people, as I say, who have this double burden.
Thank you. Our next story looks at a Forbes story. Is an MBA worth it after COVID-19? Absolutely not. Pauline Karpis argues that the value of business schools has been diminishing for a while, and most importantly, a two-year business school education simply isn't sufficient for today's careers. My students, says Paulina, are not looking for one-and-done education. They know that the constant industry disruption we faced over our lifetime, now accelerated by COVID-19, means they must continually learn about the latest trends, broaden their networks, and keep up with the ever-changing skills required for success. She concludes, it's time for many of these outdated institutions, which lure students with prestige, saddle them with debt, and rob them of their most formative years, to go the way of Blockbuster. Kate, would you agree with Karpis that change is coming because students expect more and they deserve more?
I think I take issue with quite a lot of the assertions. I know you've given an abbreviated version, but you don't learn, firstly, if we're talking about undergraduate degrees, where she seems to be lumping all degrees together, you don't just learn about knowledge, you learn critical thinking, research skills, how to put forward a case. And those skills, which I consider essential employability skills for knowledge workers, are never going to get out of date, certainly not in our lifetimes. Whether the MBA curriculum, which seems to incur her wrath more than other programmes, is relevant, current, up to date, probably not. It will always be out of date because things are changing so quickly. But at least you have a basic understanding of marketing strategy, of strategic planning tools, of effective HR processes, and all the other personal development skills that you can obtain from doing an MBA. So I would still say to people, maybe you're not going to get the great return on investment that one used to hope to get from an MBA, but it's certainly better than not doing an MBA. You're not going to stand out from the crowd just because you haven't got an MBA when all the other applicants for the jobs that you're going to have them. And I think this is what people forget sometimes we can say that a degree isn't really worth it, but not having one is probably worth less.
Thank you, Kate. And that concludes this week's episode. Listeners can find further topical content in the News and Views section on the Institute's website at www.instituteLM.com. And thank you once again, Kate, for your insights on these stories.
Thank you, Rod.